Soon as I get this going, okay. Now we're live, so if you want any comments, you better speak out now. On the microphone. All right, so what's this example useful for? It kind of shows that if you have a compound, such as primethamine, which you don't really care about, but if blood is 7.4 and urine is 6.0, what's one of the things that you notice very quickly in terms of total concentrations? It's higher in urine than it is in blood. Why is that? So it's basically getting trapped on that side. So if we think of compounds like phenobarbital, aspirin, or salicylates in general, if we alkalinize the urine, we can trap those chemicals in the urine. If we acidify the urine, we can trap things like amphetamine or phencyclidine or a number of the psychotropic agents. So depending on the properties of the actual drug itself, you can manipulate the system to trap things out on the urine side. Anything that's trapped in the urine then is just going to get eliminated from the body. And so you no longer would have to worry about it. So on Wednesday, you can expect a little problem dealing with this. All right? You're supposed to have a quiz, so you'll have a little problem on this, okay? So you might rethink Henderson-Hasselbalch. All right. So let's talk more about pharmacodynamic changes. Let's consider a little bit of receptor biochemistry. Now you've had a lot of this already, right? In biochem, but we'll just kind of look at it quickly. What's important when you think about physiologic receptors? Most receptors interface with some kind of a secondary messenger system to elicit some kind of a pharmacologic response. So when you think of a messenger, you kind of have to think of what is it going to bind to or react with in order to produce its response. So if we think of, beta receptors. Beta adrenergic receptors bind to GS proteins, and if they bind to GS proteins, what gets turned on? Adenylate cyclase, cyclic AMP goes up. Okay. Now if you have alpha-2 agonists, they bind to a GI protein. What happens to adenylate cyclase? The activity goes down. What happens if you have something like alpha-1 agonists or acetylcholine or serotonin? It binds to a GQ protein. If you bind to GQ, what happens? We've got an ion channel that's going to change here. You can have some effects on potassium channels, for one thing. The other thing that happens is you can activate phospholipase C. What happens if you activate phospholipase C? DAG, IP3. And what ion? Calcium. Well, that's kind of important because if you think of an alpha-1 agonist, what does it normally do? It's a vasoconstrictive substance. So if it raises calcium, you got more calcium available for the muscles to contract. So if, when you put it all together with its ultimate pharmacologic response, understanding the receptors and what they do and how they interface with other cellular components is important. We know that in terms of intracellular receptors, we've got specific receptors for lots of things. Enzymes, signaling proteins, steroid binding receptors. There are huge numbers of membrane-spanning enzymes, got ion channels, and of course the G protein links. So it's going to be important that you think about what the downstream effector ultimately is. And especially when we're dealing with autonomics, you're going to be dealing with a receptor. You know what it's doing biochemically, and then you can put the physiology to it, and all of a sudden it should all match. And if it doesn't match, then there ought to be questions firing off in your mind. Why not? What's going on? So things that are constrictors oftentimes affect the concentration of calcium. Things that relax smooth muscle often act through a cyclic AMP mechanism. Some things like acetylcholine act through ion channels. So you're increasing firing rates and things of that nature. So understanding receptors and what they do downstream can match with the response. And it all ought to make some sense in your mind. So it's not like you've learned a bunch of disparate facts now. You need to begin to put them together so that you can go from, okay, here's a drug and it produces this response and I know how it does it. Because for a lot of the things we're going to talk about, all of this makes sense. Oh yeah, we got a lot of other drugs that we can't say that about, but at least with autonomics, we can explain it. And so will you be able to once we get through that section. So recognize this and understand that. Okay. One of the things that happens with pharmacology that we probably ought to talk about is receptor desensitization. What do we mean here? We got a receptor, it binds to an agonist, and then somehow it gets messed up. What's going on? Well, we got an example of the desensitization of the beta receptor here. You can see that initially you put the drug in the system. This is often a tissue bath. You can use guinea pig bronchial smooth muscle, for example. You put in an agonist, say a beta agonist. It should increase cyclic AMP. That muscle should relax. But then with time, even though the agonist is in there, it ceases to respond. What's happening? Well, the biochemists help us to appreciate, we can explain what's going on mechanistically. But from a pharmacologic perspective, what I want you to take home today is the fact that the receptor is no longer able to bind the agonist because it's been bound up. It can't act anymore. It's become desensitized. You got plenty of drug in the system, but it can't bind, can't act, doesn't produce the expected response. Many receptors elicit this kind of phenomenon when the agonist is around too long and the subsequent internal system gets altered by normal binding and can't get altered back to react to more agonist. So the system needs time then to go from available to do something to available to do something again. So receptor desensitization happens quite a bit. So after reaching an initial maximal response, the response generally diminishes even in the presence of the agonists. So when we deal with tolerance to drugs, receptor desensitization is one of the mechanisms that happens. Okay.
So it's not that the receptors are saturated, it's that they've actually changed, or they can't bind more?
Right. So there's an intracellular change in the mechanism. And depending on the receptor, the change is in different places. Yes, sir? The agonist can still bind, but the intracellular change can't occur because the intracellular mechanism is still in an activated state and hasn't moved back to the point where it can be activated again. Nick? You had your hand up too?
Right.
Oh, Sean?
So, for this picture, is it basically saying that because of that phosphorylation?
Yes. Right. Tim.
So the way this is working is it's already been turned down, so you can't turn it on.
So, receptors activated, what happens? Phosphorylation occurs. Phosphorylated system can't function anymore. It does what it does and then it stops. So in order to keep the system going again and again and again, dephosphorylation has to occur. Okay? And as long as you can get the binding here, but once this occurs, this becomes an inactive system. So you have to get this unit off, and then when the agonist trips it, it binds again, and you get a response downstream. So you don't have to get bogged down in the mechanism. The point was simply to show that, you know, if you love the biochemistry, you can get bogged down in the mechanism. But for this course, what you need to understand is that pharmacologic responses can diminish with time, even in the presence of a drug, because of receptor desensitization. The downstream system is unable to respond. And this differs for every different receptor system. So the mechanism differs depending on what the other components of the downstream system are. So receptor desensitization, the response through that system diminishes because receptor is incapable of responding even to the presence of that agonist. Okay. Is that clear to everybody? All right. What about dose response curves? We like dose response curves. At the bottom of the page, we talk about some definitions. We got graded dose response curves, degree of effect versus dose or concentration. And so one of the things that we can determine if we go back to this, which you guys can't see. If this is 100%, we can talk about what happens at the 50% level, and we can then come up with an ED50, or an effective dose that produces a 50% response. EC50, ED50. Either one. Doesn't matter. Effective concentration or effective dose. If you're doing strict binding type studies, you'll refer to things as the concentration. But we could call it the ED50. Let's see, what is this? Log dose. And so what it is the concentration that elicits a 50% effect. What is important by this term? We can compare drugs, and you're going to have sales reps coming in and telling you, my drug is more potent than the competitors. What does that really mean? That means that in terms of drug A versus B, the EC50 or ED50 for A is lower than it is for B, so it takes less drug to produce that 50% response for A than it does for B. Does it matter? Does potency matter? 99 times out of 100, in terms of a clinically significant response, potency is not important. What's important is whether or not you can get that response. because the more potent drug is going to produce more than likely similar side effects as the other drug. Now, sometimes that may not be the case, but potency is not necessarily all that it's cracked up to be. All it means is that the amount of drug that's required to produce that effect is greater for one drug and lesser for another. But we calculate those things in this way. A great example of this is in, let's talk about beta blockers. You're going to see so many beta blockers you want to throw up. What's the major difference in the beta blockers? They differ in their potencies. Some people say, okay, Nadolol. Nadolol can be given once a day in the treatment of hypertension. You give a very low concentration because it's about five times more potent than propranolol, which is kind of the prototype for the class. So everything's compared to propranolol. Other drugs have to be given twice a day, and they may require more drug. So with Nadolol, you might give 20 to 50 milligrams. With propranolol, you might give 150 to 300 milligrams. But guess what? Propranolol can be dosed once a day for hypertension too. So what have you gained? Well, yeah, you're using less drug because this other one's more potent. So what do the companies do? They're going to adjust the dosage that you will prescribe according to the relative potencies of the agents. So if you ask the average clinician who uses beta blockers every day in his practice, the first thing they'll tell you is a beta blocker is a beta blocker is a beta blocker, and all that other stuff is not that important. Now with other systems, it is a little more important, so I shouldn't overgeneralize. But we can generate through a dose response type experiment a curve like this, and we can calculate an effective concentration that produces 50% response, and that's how we compare potencies of drugs with that act on the same receptor system. So that's what you need to remember. Okay, quantile dose response curves represent a percent responding to a population or a dose, tends to increase indicate the potential variability of response among individuals. So in a quantile dose response situation, you're really talking about a population. So we could do a graded dose response curve. How do I react to drug A? Or we could do a quantile dose response curve of how does the class do with drug A? And that's kind of the primary difference. And so that's why I say that the EC50 and the ED50 are essentially the same terms from a practitioner's perspective. So the ED50 then becomes a dose at which 50% of the population exhibits that effect. The TD50 now would be a toxic dose. So sometimes we'll talk about A and B as being different effects. So this could be what we want, so wanted effect, and this could be a side effect. David. It's a tough question to answer. I mean, I can see where you're coming from. I'm not sure I can give you a simple answer. Let me think about it some more. But to go back to this example, let's say we're talking about atropine. And let's say we want to produce dry mouth because the patient's going in for surgery. So dry mouth is xerostomia. One of the concentration, low doses will produce this drying of the mouth, drying of bronchial secretions, the glands, tears, and all this stuff. So a low dose of atropine will produce that. If you go to a higher dose, you might end up with a situation where you end up with, say, photophobia. What's photophobia? It's an aversion to bright light because your eyes have dilated out. Okay? So in this case, we could compare then the ED50s for the two dose response curves, and some might call this kind of a toxic response. And so you might say, well, we now can selectively use a drug within a certain concentration range to be selective on the activity that it produces without getting into side effects, because we know we've got a window in which we can work. We can also extrapolate from that to, let's deal with something else. Let's deal with something like dioxin. Dioxin can be used to increase the force of contraction of the heart. So it's a positive inotropic agent. But its effects, if the dose gets too high, are arrhythmias. These arrhythmias can be life-threatening. So now we're not dealing with a side effect anymore, we're dealing with a toxic effect. Not just some nuisance side effect, but a toxic effect. We can do the same calculation though, and we can find out that we've got ED50s, or since this is what we want, we'll call this one an ED50. Since we don't want this one, we can call this a toxic D50. And then the question becomes, how do these curves relate to one another? Are they close together or are they far apart? And that's this concept called a therapeutic index, which is simply a ratio of TD50 to ED50. And so in the case of dioxin now, you've got a drug with a narrow therapeutic index. So what we might find is that the ED50 is 1 milligram and the TD50 is 1.5 milligrams. Very small difference to push the patient from something that's desirable and good to something that could be life-threatening. So drugs with a narrow therapeutic index then have dose response curves that could almost be superimposable. Sometimes though you get a little different situation. Sometimes you get a situation where instead of having, and these were supposed to be parallel, but instead of having parallel dose response curves, you could have something like this, where they begin to overlap. So sometimes when you have non-parallel curves, people will end up doing the TD1 over the ED99. Again, all it is a different way of analyzing where these curves are and trying to come up with a therapeutic index or just an indication of how safe the compound might be. So we derive a lot of information from dose response curves. And this information is used in trying to come up with the simple assessment, is a compound safe or not? And that's where it comes from. Okay. Now sometimes people want to try to look at binding or saturation curves as a function of a dose response curve. And so I've given you an example of that in the handout. We can look at a graded dose response curve and we can have a binding response curve. So we're able to measure the effect of a drug in a single individual. You can see that they're able to produce a maximal response. You can calculate an effective dose for 50% of the response, but you can also, if you want to, generate a binding curve. What's the binding curve really doing? I should let you guys explain this, but the Bmax, or maximal binding, is similar to Emax. The Kd, the binding constant, is similar to the EC50. So mathematically then, when you get into wanting to do this kind of stuff, you can actually go back and forth between binding data and dose response data and make sense out of it. So the Kd is the concentration at which, say, 50% of the receptors are bound, and the Bmax would be the maximal number of receptors. So again, you've got percent of receptors bound, so here's 100%, and then the Kd would be the concentration at which half of them are bound. Yeah. So here in this example, Kd and EC50 are the same. So yeah, you can get that relationship of binding and the number of receptors and the effective dose and all that stuff. So, it's just, you know, if you can think this way, then you can think this way. If you want to think this way, you can go from the binding data to the dose response data. The shape of the dose response curve is often determined by an underlying biochemical mechanism. So sometimes you'll see situations where you've got a dose response curve that, say, looks like this, and then you'll have another one that might do this. What could be the differences in these two dose response curves? Many times a drug is metabolized, and that metabolic rate caps out. So it's a saturable system, it's a limited system. And so biotransformation in this case could limit this curve so that it can't get the same maximal response. You could have transport systems that max out, capacity limited transport that prevents the system from responding. So there, the shape of the curve can differ depending on what's going on biochemically within the system. So the point of all of this really is to just show you that there are different techniques that can be used to gather information about the drugs, and this information is often transmitted to practitioners, and you're kind of expected to understand it. But at the same time, the drug reps hope that you'll just listen to them and switch to their product because they've got something that's different. For example, among the ACE inhibitors, captopril has a sulfhydryl group. Enalapril does not. So for years, the company that marketed enalapril was saying, because it doesn't have a sulfhydryl group, it doesn't have the cough that captopril does. Well, if you look at the data, all the ACE inhibitors, whether they have a free sulfhydryl or not, have cough, and it has to do with their effects through the bradykinin system. It has nothing to do with the chemical structure. But it was kind of marketed that way because it was a difference that they could talk about. All right, get off my soapbox here. Drug binding and drug effects. Let's see. The biggest thing, I guess, that's important at this point is thinking about spare receptors. Spare receptors is really the theory that there are more receptors downstream, more receptors available than there are mechanisms for the downstream events That make any sense yet? Okay. You can bind all kinds of receptors, but if you don't have the mechanism downstream to produce the response, you can't get the response. So what spareReceptor says is we've got 1,000 receptors, but the cell has 50 downstream effector systems to do things. So oftentimes what you end up doing is you can give more and more drug and you can still get that maximal response, but you can't get beyond that maximal response. But if you hit the system with an inhibitor, what you see are parallel shifts in the dose response curves until you max out the number of receptors. So in this situation, we could have parallel shifts of the dose response curve, and this could be with an inhibitor concentration of 0, so no inhibitor. Inhibitor equals, say, 1, inhibitor equals 2. But eventually, at some point, you begin to get a system like this where the maximal begins to drop. So we could say this is inhibitor concentration 3. So what's happening is, because there's so many extra receptors around, you can give plenty of inhibitor, bind it up, and doesn't matter, the agonist is still able to produce a maximal response. But you saturate all those receptors. Once you've reached that saturation point, your maximal response begins to drop. That's where this theory of spare receptors has come from. And spare receptors are important from the standpoint of recognizing that if you're going to play pharmacological games with blockers, sometimes you need to modify the amount that you're using. You may need more blocker to shift this whole curve to the point where you begin to see the inhibition coming in. Some people vary in terms of the amount of blocker they might need in order to get the desired response. With temporal spare receptors, the response persists longer than the actual drug receptor binding time. This is very common with the G proteins. So with temporal spare receptors, the response persists longer than actual drug receptor binding time. So temporal spare receptors are common with G protein coupled receptors. With numeric spare receptors, there are just plain more receptors than downstream components. Most cells have a slew of beta receptors on their membranes, but they have a very discrete number of adenyl cyclase units. Okay. All right. So spare receptors, let's see, exist when a maximal response can be elicited by a concentration that doesn't result in occupancy of all the receptors. It's basically what we illustrated there. Okay. Next, what do we need to think about? Let's talk a little bit about agonists and antagonists. We often talk about being full or partial agonists. This is kind of a confusing situation because sometimes we'll talk about an antagonist that's a partial agonist. What in the world are we doing? Mixing our terms? Partially, but partially it's because the drug is dirty. It's got extra effects on it. So when we think about an agonist, a pure agonist, it elicits a maximal effect. So again, you got the right dose and you got the right experimental system, a pure agonist will produce a maximal effect. So let's say you now have another compound. Let's say you've taken acetylcholine and you've changed its structure somewhat to make methylcholine, we'll talk about later on next week. What happens? Do you get it? Is it a full agonist? Can it produce that same maximal effect? And the answer is, well, in this case, yes. So you'll know that it's a full agonist. But sometimes you don't. So you can have what's called a partial agonist. And so we've got a graph there on that page to show the differences between full and partial agonists. You can see that the maximal response is lower. Sometimes the curve is shifted to the left, which is what this particular curve is showing. So you can get more and more and more and more partial agonists. You can really raise that concentration way up, but you'll never get the maximal response that the tissue is capable of giving. So a partial agonist will not give you a maximal response, even if all the receptors are occupied. It's just not capable of doing that. So if you were to look at this curve, what's the distinction between a full agonist and a partial agonist? Well, we've got two things that we often compare. One is EC50. So with a partial agonist, the EC50 is reduced. So the Emax, the maximal is always reduced. So whether it's a binding curve and you're looking at Bmax, or a dose response curve and you're looking at Emax, Emax is going to be reduced with a partial agonist. Efficacy is often decreased. Now the ED50, in this example, is changed also. Which way did the ED50 change? We got to watch our terms. What do you mean going up? It's more potent. Yeah, so it's in. But that may not occur. The curve could have been on this side too. Okay, so Your ED50 value may increase or decrease with a partial agonist. And so if you're reading the literature and somebody's got this brand new agent and they're getting ready to come in and they want you to prescribe it and they think this is the best agent in this class of drugs because there should be some data associated with it. You know, they should talk about relative potencies or ED50s or something. They should talk about TDs of some kind or a therapeutic index of some kind, because most drugs are always compared back to their prototype within a class. We have new classes that start, and then everything you know is about that brand new drug in that new class. But then as more Me Too's come along, they're going to get compared back to that original agent. And so you're going to compare Emaxes, you're going to compare ED50s and things like that. So understanding then the distinctions between a full and a partial agonist are important. The partial agonist will not give you the maximal response of that tissue. Okay. The final thing to think about today has to do with a discussion of blocking drugs or antagonists. Antagonists act in a number of ways. Yes, Sean.
What if you give a
Well, what would it depend on? Would depend on the binding affinity of the full agonist relative to the partial agonist on the system. One would think there would be competition for binding, that's true, so you might think it's going to be somewhere in between, but where it's going to fall might depend on differences in affinities. The partial agonist is more avidly bound, then you might see the same EC50, but if it's not, it would be less. Okay, yes ma'am.
Partial agonist, even though it's more potent,
Still giving a lower maximal dose?
Yes. So partial agonists basically give you a lower maximal response, and the ED50 may or may not change.
When you give a drug, aren't you going for the effective dose rather than the maximal dose? Like, are you ever trying to get the maximal response, or are you just trying to give enough to get an effective response? I guess I'm confused, like, if a partial agonist still has an effective dose, why would you give a full agonist?
Okay, but I don't want to answer that. No, I said how. Well, that may be true too, but.
I take it back. Never mind. I don't care.
Ultimately, as a practitioner, the agents that you will be using are going to be packaged and marketed in appropriate concentrations so that you can get the therapeutic effect that you want. Okay, so experimentally, you're not going to have to necessarily discern that. So if this is a partial agonist and it will do what you want it to do, then you can use it, even though it doesn't elicit a maximal response that the tissue is capable of giving. Okay, so there are agents that are partial agonists to the beta 2 receptor that will cause bronchodilation. But they are not so strong on beta 2s in the heart, so they produce less speed increases or inotropic responses in the heart because they're partial agonists. And so in that case, you might have a little less side effect, but still get the desirable effect out of it. So there are a lot of things that this information can help one, but usually it's the experimentalist that's playing with it and not you.
For the partial agonists, do you count the ED50 as where it was? Because, I mean, if you're trying to get the 50 where it was in the full agonist, you don't count it where it was, so you just move it back. But if the effective dose that the patient wanted was supposed to be for the full agonist.
Well, if you want this kind of a response, and this is the curve that you're working with, then you can't use an ED50 concentration. Okay, you're going to have to dose it up in here, which is probably going to be an ED90 dose in order to get that kind of a maximal response. So if you were trying to match this response here, you'd need a whole lot more drug than the ED50. Right?
I was just saying, like, you call that effective.
Well, the ED50 is the response, or is a 50% response for that system. So with this particular curve, you can calculate an ED50. And if all you're doing is comparing ED50s, then this drug is more potent than this drug. But because it's a partial agonist, it's never going to produce the same maximal effect that the full agonist will produce in that biologic system. Let's go with Tim first, and then. Depends if you're talking a graded response curve or a population, a quantile response curve.
I just want to clarify that the ED50 is almost a drug independent.
Yeah, that would be correct. So the system, 50% of the system's maximal response would be your ED50. Okay. We're going to try to finish up with antagonists. What are some examples? Competitive reversible antagonist. If you have a competitive reversible antagonist, which way does the dose response curve go? So it's going to shift to the right. And if it's competitive, what kind of curve will you have? Identical curve, just shifted to the right. Now what happens if you have an irreversible antagonist? If you have an irreversible antagonist, your maximum should drop, but you really shouldn't see much of a shift of the curve. So if all receptors are bound, and you hit it with an irreversible antagonist, you should begin to see a decrease in the maximal response. Okay. Then, of course, if you're dealing with a non-competitive antagonist, it can bind to some other site in that receptor, for example. It might prevent the agonist action. You expect to see a decrease in the EC. You expect to see a decrease in Emax. So with antagonists, most of the time that we're going to be talking about antagonists, we're going to be dealing with reversible antagonism, and you would expect parallel shifts, similar maxes, but the ED50 for the agonist will require, it'll require more and more drug of the agonist, more and more agonist to get a response. With irreversible antagonists, you see a reduction in Emax for the system. Okay. Non-competitive, the curve can be lots of different ways, but the bottom line is EC50s, the Emax is going to drop. Yes. For competitive, irreversible, or for non-competitive, Emax decreases. Okay. Tell you what, we'll stop here. Questions? You guys don't like those responses, I can tell. You're not unique.